The Chase Down Podcast presents A City of Champions, a seven-part series chronicling the Cavs' 2016 NBA Championship. With help from fans who cheered against us, reporters who covered it, and the players who watched it, we'll take you game by game through the most improbable 3-1 comeback in championship history. Be sure to subscribe to the Chase Down Podcast to relive the greatest series we've seen in our lifetimes.
One dribble, steps back, puts up a three, won't go, rebound tip taken by Spates, final seconds, it's over, it's over! Cleveland is a city of champions once again. The Cavaliers are NBA champions.
The series begins Thursday, April 9th.
The Timeline is a Blue Wire podcast.
Hey, that was a good one. That was a good one. I had to show you what's up with the Suns, though. I think they're the best team in 2K right now. What do you think? They're the best team in 2K. No? He walked away? Oh. Good game, Pat. Appreciate you.
Welcome to the Timeline of Phoenix Suns podcast, back after a few weeks, and finally we have something to talk about because the Phoenix Suns are officially the 2020 NBA champions, sort of, 2K champions, I guess you could say, because DeAndre Ayton and Devin Booker somehow met in the finals of the NBA 2K tournament, and I'm Mike, of course, and with me to talk about that and more is, of course, as every week, Sam Cooper. Sam, how are you doing?
I'm pretty good. I didn't watch that. I have to be honest right off the bat. If you're listening at home and you're thinking, I didn't watch that stupid 2K tournament thing, then you're not alone because I didn't watch it either. And I think it was a cool idea and I like NBA 2K, but I'm so glad that we have another guest joining us who can maybe help us recap what actually happened a little bit.
Yeah, I watched some of it, a lot more than I watched of the first round of the horse tournament, which was... it was like old people trying to understand YouTube. It was very weird and boring, and I didn't enjoy it. But to talk about that and more, we have a very special guest. Once again, a friend of our podcast, a writer of ArizonaSports.com, host of the Empire of the Suns podcast, Kellen Olson. Kellen, how are you doing?
I'm great. Hang the banner. Got to get some kind of banner up, right? Jesus. What's up?
Oh, you know, it's been, as we were just briefly talking about before we started recording, it's been a bit of a challenge for us content folks finding things to talk about in this weird time that we're in. But at least we got to see NBA players sort of competing with each other. And I watched, like I said, I watched some of it. But Kellen, I noticed you were writing about just about every single game, at least that involved Devin Booker and DeAndre Ayton. What was your impression of that? Yeah. What was your impression of that tournament?
What a champ. More like what a extremely bored blogger, like just looking for anything. But no, it actually, I'm kidding. It actually like meshes with me really well. If people have read any of my stuff or especially like followed me on Twitter, I let it slip in there here and there, like references to video games and how much of a huge nerd I am. I got to do that luckily when Devin took a couple minutes to talk to me about before he was started streaming and all that kind of stuff. But I actually, I thought it was pretty entertaining. The first day was pretty rough until Patrick Beverley started playing, and then he was just talking shit the entire time. And it was so good, and I think I had my expectations really high for when he played DeAndre Ayton, but and it kind of got to a weird spot where Patrick wasn't really talking that much. But it was actually great because he wasn't talking that much because he just started ignoring DeAndre about like 40% through the like hour-long or two-hour-long thing of it. But I thought it was fun. I thought Devin's personality and just the way that he talks. I know I saw Mike posted a couple videos of it. I posted a couple videos of it too, of just him talking. Like Montrezl Harrell was like, man, what am I doing right now? Just like the typical thing you say when you're messing up on a video game. And then Devin just instantly says back, losing. You're losing right now. It's like, oh my God, Devin, relax. He's a really, really good shit talker. And it was just a really good platform for him to display that more than his video game skills. In and of itself, I was surprised that DeAndre lost because he posted an Instagram screenshot on his IG story, a screenshot of 2K where they have like this 3-on-3 mode called My Park, and he has over 3,800 games played, Now, the games only take like 3, 4, 5 minutes sometimes because they're so quick, but 3,800 is a lot. That's a lot of games.
Yeah.
So I didn't expect him to lose, but I guess Devin is a lot more familiar with like the quick play 5-on-5 stuff, and that's how he came away with it. But I thought it was fun to watch. I thought it was a big dub for nerds who have been trying to like defend watching video games. And then I saw a lot of people coming out and getting excited about the horse thing when we tried this like 3 years ago, didn't we, on TNT at the All-Star weekend, and it was a huge failure. Yeah, I only caught clips of that. I didn't even watch it because I wasn't interested at all, and it proved out to be good instincts by me on that part. But it was actually kind of fun to watch. Would I watch it again if they were to do another one in a couple months? No, I would not. But was it fun for like a one-off kind of thing? Yeah, sure. And if they did it maybe once a year, maybe. But like as a one-off thing, it was kind of fun.
Well, I'll say this. If they did it again, I have a better understanding of which games I would enjoy watching, because what makes it generally boring is if people are just playing 2K as they normally play 2K, which a lot of these guys, when you play online against other people, you're probably not playing against friends a lot of times, and you're just kind of sitting there silently, which some people did do. You know, there was the occasional, oh, are you still in Phoenix kind of question. But for Suns fans, I think it was pretty entertaining because it turned out that some of the most entertaining people, just personalities in the tournament, were Devin Booker and DeAndre Ayton, along with Patrick Beverley. I think those three guys were probably the most entertaining. And I think, well, one, it's easier to talk a lot of shit when you're winning, which, of course, Devin Booker and DeAndre Ayton, even though there was a best of three in the semifinals, they actually didn't lose. They went into the finals completely undefeated. So, of course, they were talking a lot of shit. And I think the two moments that I think were the most interesting and fun for me were, one, Devin Booker using Montrezl Harrell against Montrezl Harrell. So he chose the Clippers against Montrezl Harrell, and then specifically went to Harrell in like towards the end of that game where he was dominating him, and threw down some pretty amazing 2K dunks, if you will, in that game. And then the other moment, I think something that went viral, if you can say that, early in the tournament was Devin Booker making a joke about not picking the Suns for the tournament, which, who cares? I think the Suns are not that good in NBA 2K for a lot of reasons. But when Patrick Beverley and DeAndre Ayton were playing, DeAndre Ayton specifically chose the Suns in the final round against Patrick Beverley and then used the Suns to destroy Patrick Beverley. And I think that was one of the moments where Patrick Beverley stopped talking about halfway through that game, because there's not a lot to say at that point when you're losing that bad. And I think Ayton, even at the end of the game, made a point to say, I think the Suns might be the best team on NBA 2K, which I think was maybe a slightly veiled reference to Devin Booker refusing to use them. But to Kellen, do you agree that those were the best moments? Do you have any other specific moments that you enjoyed?
I have a couple. Again, like for people that know me, I love dogs. I think they're just the greatest. So seeing Devin at halftime just like basically like kissing his dog on the camera, and they actually like showed it. It was incredible. He was doing the kissy face to his dog like we all do to our dogs. Superstars. They're just like us. I did like the fact that he didn't pick the Suns, because it was just one of those things where it's the most predictable people making a deal out of this when it's no kind of deal. If you're as competitive as he is in trying to win this tournament, the only reason DeAndre picked them in game two and why Patrick Beverley called him a gangster is because Patrick Beverley was like, oh, you're the type of guy to like just drop this game and give it to me for free, and you're still that confident you're going to win game three? Like, that's tough. Like, you're pretty crazy if you think you're... And that's why like Pat Bev was saying he liked him, because he thought he was throwing away the game, essentially. And Devin just wasn't willing to do that because he wanted to win the game. And look, if the Suns were like a mid-tier 2K team, I think without a doubt both guys would have like played with them early, but they're one of the worst teams, if not the worst team in the game. And Devin himself went out on Twitter and is right and saying like he didn't think his character is all that good. I think he's only like an 86.
He is lower than Hassan Whiteside.
Oh my god,
yeah, it's pathetic. Yeah. Hopefully he goes up a couple of points after this. In fact, I was gonna ask you, Kellen, like, you're a gamer and you've written about that before, but you know, presumably you like good video games. Do you respect the NBA 2K franchise as a video game? Obviously we all play it because we like basketball and it's better than live, but are there better video games almost that would have been more entertaining to watch players kind of go head to head?
I don't know about watch, because I actually thought the gameplay was pretty fun to watch because they all knew what they were doing. But for me, is like, I don't want to call myself a novice 2K player, because like going back to like NBA Live 03, I played every basketball game that came out every year and then like transitioned into 2K around like 2K9, 2K10. But 2K's a couple of things on 2K that are always endlessly frustrating is that the help defense never helps you. Like, the computer just doesn't know what to do. And I noticed that Devin and DeAndre and a couple of other guys were going into their settings and changing all these things. So I'm assuming that you have to go into, like, these advanced settings that they've added to the game in the past couple of years to get, like, proper defense. Like, I noticed one of them was, like, telling your guy to go over a screen. But there were times where you're like playing off the ball in defense or whatever, and the guy guarding Steph Curry would go under, and you're like, what are you doing? And then the guy who's like supposed to help weak side wouldn't help. And then like as it was shown early in the tournament, when guys weren't that good at the game like I am, you just miss layups all the time. So for me, I've always thought the game is like mid tier, like at best for like a sports game. I think FIFA's awesome. I play FIFA every year. I'm trying to think of what else really in terms of sports games. I don't play The Show, but I know a lot of people who stand by that game for the past couple of years or so. I always say that the best sports games of all time were the NFL Street and NBA Street ones. I put like hundreds of hours into those when I was like a teenager, yeah. And those are elite to me. But yeah, like MVP Baseball back in the day on PS2. But FIFA's still pretty good. NHL is still pretty good. But 2K is kind of falling off in my opinion.
Yeah, I wonder if they're going to try to do anything else. You know, there's still some time here. If the season was going, it would be about, you know, ending relatively soon, the regular season. But normally we'd have another 2 months of basketball on our hands, basically, and we're not going to get that. So I wonder if they're going to try and fill it with anything else. Obviously, this horse tournament is happening. Not a lot of engagement that I've seen online, so I doubt the ratings are really high on that horse tournament. And I would guess that the ratings were higher for the 2K tournament, but I am in a Suns bubble on the internet. So obviously there were two Suns players throughout the entire tournament. So I saw a lot of people talking about that. So I do wonder if they're going to try something else. Sam, you play 2K, right?
Yeah, of course I do. I don't know. I just couldn't find myself sitting down and actively wanting to watch this tournament to defend myself. Like, yeah, I play 2K, and yeah, I like DeAndre Ayton and Devin Booker and Patrick Beverley too. Like, I saw the highlights and kind of Bev's commentary really emphasizes the same sort of thing we see from him on the court when he's playing real basketball. Yeah. I mean, it's just really entertaining, and a reason why I saw you tweet about it, Mike. It would be awesome to have a character like that on the Suns for many reasons.
Yeah.
But I don't know, just something about sitting down and really watching the guys go at it when half of them were silent to begin with throughout most of the broadcast didn't really sit well with me.
Yeah. I think that announcers could have helped for some of the more boring types of personalities that were playing for the players. You know, a lot of them aren't. Like Derek Jones Jr. probably said 10 words the entire game that he played. And it's just not his type of thing to be out there, the entertainer, if you will, just by talking. That's not easy. Sam, what's your build for your 2K player?
I am a playmaking sharpshooter. I haven't played in a while.
Okay.
Shooting guard. Yeah.
Kellen, what's your build?
I was a 7'3" Asian center the last time I played my apartment. And I was just like, because everyone wanted to be like a ball handler and a point guard and like a 6'7" point guard. I was like, I'm just going to sit in the key. I'll just be here if you need me.
Yeah. I mean, those are the best teammates.
Yeah. It's hard to screw up too. So makes it easy for me.
Yeah. Those are the best teammates. I'm a 6'5", playmaking shot creator, point guard type of player. I made James Harden, basically.
You made James Harden.
And Devin Booker, yeah, he's left-handed, so I always refer to him as James Harden. But
you made Manu Ginobili.
Yeah, exactly. I made Manu Ginobili. And, you know, it's a fun game. 2K can be frustrating. I stream it sometimes. If you guys want to watch me play it, I can play it sometimes. I'm not very good. It's one of those games that's difficult. If you don't have other friends that play it, you're probably going to lose a lot. That's just how it works. But a relatively fun tournament. I appreciate you, Kellen, doing all the work and writing about it. I think there was a lot to cover in that. With currently no NBA, NHL, or MLB, you might think there's nothing to bet on. Well, you'd be wrong. Our exclusive partner BetOnline still has hundreds of events, games, and props to wager on. From their online casino to poker and blackjack, they're bringing Vegas to you. Missing the NFL? No problem. BetOnline has live daily Madden NFL 20 simulations that you can bet on. You can still bet on Survivor, Big Brother, American Idol, stock prices, and even the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest. All open 24 hours a day and all online. Use promo code BLUEWIRE to join today and receive your new welcome bonus. Bet online, your online wagering solution. Another reason that we wanted to have you on this episode specifically, Kellen, was to talk about a team that I feel like somehow Sam and I have not talked about a lot over the course of this podcast, which has been about 2 years now. We're almost at 100 episodes of this podcast, and a few more episodes will be at 100. One episode that we did, we covered just about every single move of Ryan McDonough's general manager career, and that was the only episode where we touched on the 2014-15 Phoenix Suns, which I think, looking back, is kind of one of the more fascinating Phoenix Suns years in recent memory. And I had been thinking about this just randomly recently because there's no basketball on, of course. And then Isaiah Thomas, the current player Isaiah Thomas, Instagrammed a photo, the legendary photo of Isaiah Thomas, Goran Dragic, and Eric Bledsoe all holding on to one basketball. And he made a point of saying that this team would work better, that 14-15 Suns team would work better in today's NBA. Arguably, the NBA is the same as it was 5 years ago, but we can talk about that a little bit. PJ Tucker jumped in the comments and said that was working then in the 14-15 year. And I thought it would be a good time to just look back on that season and do a little bit of a retrospective, post-mortem type of conversation about that team and see what we think about it and sort of the what-ifs that happened in that season. I'll start with this, and Kellen, we'll start with you. Just from a general standpoint, and we'll get into the nitty-gritty because we got a lot of time here, but we'll get into the nitty-gritty on this. But from a general standpoint, do you agree with the assertion by Isaiah Thomas that that team would work well in today's NBA?
Oh, it depends on how you define well. Would that team win 40 to 45 games? I think so. And me and you both tweeted out like some of the stats a bit, and I included it in our post on the site, and that I think they were outscoring teams by like 3 to 4 points when those three were on the court. And the thing about them three on the court wasn't like you're unlocking some huge unstoppable offense with those three guys on the court. It was more you have to play the three of those together from time to time in order to get them enough minutes. And they eventually opened up to that idea more in January. And then I think Isaiah Thomas kind of realized by like December that he's just got to make the most of his role. And I think he felt comfortable in what his role was. But I think that it was something Cole Zwicker talks about a lot with the draft is that he's learning every single year. And he's like, he learned so much the first draft that he scouted. And that was a season that like me as someone like, quote unquote, covering a basketball team, but I wasn't actually in person covering them yet. I was just writing about them on Bright Side of the Sun. I learned a lot about that team just because the thing people forget about the 48 win year is that Bledsoe and Dragic barely actually played together because Bledsoe had his injuries in there mixed in. And then I think didn't Dragic have a couple as well? I might be wrong there in saying that, but there was basically a large period where Bledsoe was injured. Yeah. Dragic missed like five games. So not really, but Bledsoe missed half the season. So those guys didn't really have to figure it out a ton together. And then Ryan McDonough was like, you know, what's a great idea. A ball dominant guard off the bench. That's what's going to be a great idea that we need to play 25 minutes a game. But me at the time, I saw the deal when I was at Summer League and I was like, oh, this is awesome. Because if it doesn't work, you've got him on the super affordable deal and you basically created an asset for yourself. But the risk was completely blowing up what worked for you and it completely blew up what worked for them.
Yeah. Yeah, I tend to agree there. Sam, same question on that. Do you agree with Isaiah Thomas's thoughts on that one?
I do. First of all, I think it's funny. I want to point out PJ Tucker's not the only one who showed up in the comments. Tyler Ennis, if you guys remember him, also commented. He said it was fun watching y'all. I had first row seats every night and then a crying
emoji.
So I thought, I thought that was funny. But shout out Tyler Ennis, wherever he may be now. But beyond that, I think Like, Mike, you called this one of the most interesting seasons in Suns history, or at least recent. In Suns' recent history. Yeah. But I think it's one of the most interesting seasons in NBA history of, like, any team, just because of how absurd it is. You know, I couldn't look it up anywhere, but 23 players on a roster over a single season has to be close to a record, I would think. Mm. And just, it's the complete intersection of taking statistical-based logic and basketball strategy, on-court basketball strategy, combined with the complete lack of respect for any sort of human emotion. It's just those two forces colliding and is really at the heart of what made the Ryan McDonough era in Phoenix so fascinating. Like, as Kellen was talking about, statistically, these three guys on the court together worked. You know, I threw together some four-man combinations. Those three guys plus PJ Tucker had a plus 4.6 net rating. Those three guys plus Markieff Morris plus 4.9. For some reason, those three guys plus Alex Len was a plus 11 net rating. For some reason, you know? And I think, you know, furthermore, I think the league today is a little bit different than it was 5 years ago. And so if you assembled this roster today, they're going to shoot more threes. Maybe having guys like Gerald Green and the Morris twins shooting more threes on the outside, maybe that makes the penetration of Isaiah Thomas, Eric Bledsoe, even more dangerous on the inside. So they're going to be shooting more threes. Maybe you're going to have a guy like PJ Tucker more permanently play at a position like power forward, if not even center, if you wanted to go full Houston Rockets. And you can kind of eliminate like a regressing Miles Plumlee sort of out of the equation a little bit. So, yeah, I mean, I think this could be a successful team in the sense that for a team without any on-paper all-star talent, they could definitely win 45, maybe even 50 games. Would the chemistry still be an issue on a team with so many colliding egos, so many, you know, 24, 25, 20-somethings mm-hmm. type players who haven't actually proven right. anything in the league yet? That chemistry would still be an issue.
Yes, I think that's one of the main points about this is how do you get a 28-year-old prime Dragic and a 25-year-old Isaiah Thomas and a 25-year-old Eric Bledsoe to accept a smaller role when all three of those guys are essentially in that sort of mid-20s range. If one of them was a few, like say Dragic was 30 instead of 28, maybe he'd be more willing to take a little less ball-dominant role, maybe, mm-hmm. but maybe not. I mean, he is less ball-dominant now that he's on a team with Jimmy Butler. So it just depends on the situation. But just to set the table a little bit for people who don't remember, the 2013-14 Phoenix Suns was the 48-win Phoenix Suns. It was the first year, full year, with Goran Dragic and Eric Bledsoe, just as Kellen was talking about. Bledsoe did hurt himself in the middle of the year. That was the year that Goran Dragic missed the All-Star team. The Suns won 48 games, which is still currently the record of the most wins for a team that did not make the playoffs, and then Dragic was named to an All-NBA team at the end of the year. That team had PJ Tucker, Gerald Green, Channing Frye, Markieff Morris. Miles Plumlee somehow was pretty good. Leandro Barbosa on his last legs before he went on to win a championship. And then, of course, that was a season where, had the Suns just stood pat, just not changed anything, and just re-signed, say, Channing Frye, for example, they might have made the playoffs the next year. But going into that offseason, a couple things happened. First of all, Sam put together some notes for us, which I think is funny. One of the first notes that you have here is PJ Tucker's super extreme DUI.
Yeah, that happened. That happened.
That did happen. And then so that affected the beginning of the season slightly because
when lovable fan favorite PJ Tucker is getting a super extreme DUI to start the season and getting suspended, you know you're in for a total shit show, because that was just the beginning, and virtually every other player, I mean, it just spiraled out of control.
That was the veteran leader.
It was the veteran leader.
You know, obviously PJ Tucker has an interesting career, as we all know. In that 14-15 season, he was 29 years old, but he didn't really go into the NBA like a normal NBA player would. He bounced around different leagues before making it in the NBA. So not quite the same as a normal 29-year-old player. I think one of the biggest things, I looked back on some Reddit threads about this team during that time, and I saw comments from both me and Sam. Actually, Sam, I saw some of your comments as well, which was kind of interesting because we were a little bit younger.
Call me out.
We were a little bit dumber, I think.
I was a lot dumber. Call me out. Well, by all means.
But one of the things I noticed that I was frustrated with at the time was not re-signing Channing Frye onto this team. Is that something that you remember, Kellen Olsen? And how, what are your thoughts on Channing Frye not being retained?
Yeah, it was tough because like it's not like he went to Orlando and was lighting the league up again. It kind of just fizzled out there, and that was it. I remember that they were just in a tough spot in terms of how much money he wanted and how much money he was getting around the league, because they're just. Aren't a lot of players like that in his skill set, even in today's NBA when there's so many more guys shooting like that 5 years later compared to him. But there just wasn't anyone like him, so it was very difficult for them to hold on to him at the price range they wanted. But, I mean, you look at it in a 48-win team with the pieces that they had. If you have to overpay for one of your best veterans, then you should do that. And it was a mistake to let him go. They would have been... It's one of those moves where McDonough and the picture of asset trees and having all these assets and building for a championship contender, you look at signing Frye and say, can we win a playoff series with him? Maybe, probably not, but can you make the playoffs with him? Yes. And can you have a good team with him? Yes. And that should have mattered more than them looking at this like they're going to build off 48 wins and try and protect their potential for the next couple of years going forward. And I think that was their mistake.
Yeah, it still bothered me. I think that even still to this day, looking back at that 48-win season in 13-14, I think Channing is an underrated part of that season. He played all 82 games. He started all 82 games, and he shot 37% from three, and that's at 5 3-point attempts per game.
Well, they did try to replace it with Anthony Tolliver.
That's true.
That was an experiment. That was tried for about 10 games, if you remember. And that's kind of what's so crazy to me about this season is I think when you think back to 2015, you think February clusterfuck, Dragic demands a trade, Isaiah Thomas to Boston, Brandon Knight to Phoenix. And we'll get into that. But what I tend to forget is that there were three trades before any of that even happened. Like just in, you know, November, December, January, when trades don't usually happen. The first one of those included Anthony Tolliver. But then there was the Brandon Wright trade, and then there was a trade, you know, I don't even remember what, but bringing in Reggie Bullock, just like these little bench warmer moves that kind of showed us from the beginning just how anxious Ryan McDonough was as a general manager to make moves in the first place.
No, yeah, totally. And I think that the speaking of like learning things from like these types of seasons, when Miles Plumlee was like outplaying Alex Len and not even outplaying Alex Len, I would argue against that. Actually, I would say Len played better than him when he got in, but it's just more of one of those things where if Eliakobo can't beat out Javon Carter and Ty Jerome for the backup point guard spot, maybe he's the problem and it's not the problem of the coaches who aren't giving him minutes. And like it's the same kind of thing there where I think Alex Len has turned into like a serviceable backup center right now, but just looking at him in those past years where we were looking for him to get more playing time and it's like, well, actually, if like he can't get more than 20 minutes a game over Miles Plumlee, maybe there's a bigger issue at hand here. And if they're trading for Brandon Wright in December, maybe there's a bigger issue at hand here. But yeah, that's a really good point, because I think that you look at their midseason acquisitions and just how they correlated to the team and trying to find like the right group meshing where all together the problem was really clear, and that apparently Goran Dragic was super pissed off and just wanted to leave. And that... if you guys want to kind of get into the trade deadline, do you guys remember how that news cycle happened with Goran and how when he left and just kind of how it all went down?
Yeah, it was very odd. Actually, kind of funny. While researching this, I kind of went through a couple different things. The Basketball Reference page has a list of transactions for that season. Wikipedia has its own. Wikipedia weirdly lists that trade as a 7-team trade. It was not that. For some reason, Wikipedia has it wrong. But so many things happen. And I think, actually, Kellen, if you want to recap from what you remember of that Goran Dragic news cycle, you probably have a better grasp on it since you were covering the team at the time.
Yeah, I remember this specifically because of how much it pissed me off. Because at the time, I will admit that I was much, much more of a fan still than I am really at all of the team right now. And basically what Goran did was he not only leaked that he wanted to leave, he leaked a specific amount of teams that he would only sign contract extensions with. And it was three teams, four teams, five teams.
It was three teams, and it was the exact three teams you would think. It was the Knicks, the Lakers, and the Heat.
And I think Miami was like the only team that kind of made sense from that standpoint. Mm-hmm. So we were looking at Miami. So at the time when the deal went down and just we were looking at it like, oh my God, like, are they going to be able to get any value here? Like, this is insane that he did this to them. They treated him so poorly, apparently. And then to get what he got, I actually thought McDonough did well at the time.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, Kellen, I don't mean to pick on you. By no means do I mean to pick on you, but I did my research before this episode.
Oh,
I found,
yeah, go ahead.
I found a Bright Side of the Sun article.
Yeah.
Five main takeaways for the Suns after the trade deadline. Kellen Olson, February 19th, 2015. This is not, you know, this is, you were just saying what we were all thinking, is what I want to say. But say your piece. Say your piece.
No, I completely support all of my opinions that I had back then. I still think at the time that I was being reasonable. Now, it looks really stupid in hindsight.
You were.
Thank God I had like 500 followers on Twitter or 300 or whatever I had instead of now. Because
you were being totally reasonable, and I was throwing a hissy fit at the same time. You know, 16 or 17-year-old me, however old I was throwing a hissy fit over Goran Dragic at the time. But here's what you wrote. You wrote, Eric Bledsoe, here's where it starts. The big thing I see coming out of this, after all the carnage, is the core of the Suns' future might be done. Eric Bledsoe just got a new deal. Brandon Knight is about to get one unless things go horribly wrong. Markieff Morris is on a bargain contract, and Alex Len is still on his rookie deal. Add in Archie Goodwin, TJ Warren.
Oh, no.
Bogdan Bogdanovic, Marcus Morris.
Bogdan was good.
Yes, you said Archie Goodwin.
I listed Archie before TJ Warren?
Yes, you did. Well, we'll get into that in a second. You know, in TJ's rookie year, like, they were sending him back and forth to the G League a lot at that time. But you were saying add in Archie Goodwin, TJ Warren, Bogdan Bogdanovic, Marcus Morris, all of the future draft picks, and this might be it. It seems ridiculous to say this after a year and a half, but the Suns might be done with the main part of the rebuild. Whether or not this is the best group possible remains to be seen and will be up for debate. So again, there you're addressing it right there. But then you say, we've arrived. There are still assets around and more deals will probably be made, but that main core looks done. That is what you said in 2015. Again, nothing against you, because that was the reasonable thing, I think, for any Suns fan to think at the time. In hindsight, it looks absurd, obviously.
Yeah, totally. Bledsoe, I will forever argue that he was an all-star quality guard for the Suns. I've found, especially with a couple years removed, I think people have been, in my opinion, more reasonable looking back on him. But at the time, there were a lot of people, especially in the comments that you guys were on, and I was on the Bright Side comments, like, a lot of people didn't like him and didn't think he was that good. And I remember writing like this super long piece going into the year after the season, going into his first year in the new contract extension, where I was like, hey, this guy's really fucking good at basketball, and like, here are a bunch of reasons why. And I just like this guy's super strong. He shoots like the same percentage at the rim as LeBron. He's really, really good defensively. So at the time, Eric Bledsoe was like a borderline all-star guard. And then at the time, Brandon Knight looked like he could be a future all-star guard, or at least on the same level of Bledsoe in terms of like leaning in. Now, of course, that was in the East. It was only one season. Something went horribly wrong. That was completely unforeseen, in my opinion, just in terms of how quickly he fell off. Markieff Morris was pretty solid.
Yeah.
Morris was pretty solid. You look at like the two core pieces of Bledsoe and Knight, and then you just needed like a third or a fourth guy. And apparently, I thought it was important to put Archie Goodwin first out of all those pieces that could become.
Well,
but it was there in terms of like a 40 to 51 team. But I get what you're saying. Like, looking back 5 years later, it's completely ridiculous.
I do want to just point out just one thing about why Suns fans were irrationally angry about Eric Bledsoe. This offseason before that 14-15 season was the offseason where Rich Paul kind of had Eric Bledsoe hold out a little bit to get the right amount of money for the Phoenix Suns. And people were irrationally angry about that because they felt as if Eric Bledsoe, maybe this is maybe not the best wording for this, but maybe he didn't want to be there. Maybe he was trying to force his way somewhere else.
Sorry to cut you off, but do you remember at the time when it was first reported that he like wanted a new contract, or like they weren't close on talks? It came from Chris Haynes, who at the time was writing in Cleveland and wasn't writing about anything nationally, like at all. Like, he had never like quote unquote scooped anything nationally. And then this random writer out of Cleveland, where LeBron James and Rich Paul are located, just comes out with this scoop. And I was like, come on, man. Like, you can't be this obvious with it. I forget how those 2 years, despite the winning, like, these little things were so infuriating. That really pissed me off, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I think that that brazen attitude, that level of brashness, that lack of care is what makes Rich Paul Rich Paul. He doesn't care if people know where it's coming from. If the leverage is on his side, which I think it was at that time, obviously he got the contract that he got. I think looking back, that was actually a pretty good deal for Eric Bledsoe. Like that, I don't think the Suns overpaid in any way. I think he was paid relatively fairly with that contract that he got. But some Suns fans harbored some sort of resentment for him at that point. There was a point of the season where Dragic said that he intends to re-sign in Phoenix after the season as well, which obviously did not happen. But if you contrast the difference between Eric Bledsoe holding out and not saying anything, which is the right choice for Eric Bledsoe. One, he's not super captivating when he speaks. And two, if you're in the middle of a negotiation, let your agent handle it. Don't say anything. But he didn't say anything throughout the entire time. Dragic comes into the season and says he plans on re-signing. Now, I do want to take it back a little bit to the initial moment that Isaiah Thomas signed, which when I first saw that Isaiah Thomas signed in Phoenix, I thought, my first thought was, okay, well, he must be just okay with coming off the bench because there's no way he's starting for this team. They just won 48 games with two of their main core pieces being the same position that Isaiah Thomas plays. And I think it's important to point out the same position. Neither Eric Bledsoe or Goran Dragic were shooting guards. They were both point guards, and Isaiah Thomas, also a point guard. In a weird way, Isaiah Thomas, of the three of them, is the closest to being a shooting guard, although all three of them are still point guards. Do you think, from the beginning, that Goran Dragic was angry from that moment on, and did you have any indication in your mind that something else could have been going on at that moment? Sam, what did you think when you first heard that Isaiah Thomas was signing?
Can you remind me, Bledsoe hadn't signed yet, right?
I don't believe he had.
I'm trying to think what, I honestly don't remember what I thought. I think insurance, my reaction think. May have been insurance, that this might be Bledsoe's replacement. And then the news came that Bledsoe was re-signing and things got a little bit crazy. And I was thinking, what the fuck are they doing? Yeah, dude, I mean, obviously it makes sense for Dragic to have been mad at that proposition to begin with. And, you know, we saw that through with the numbers. I pulled up the numbers, and the season before, Dragic averaged 78 touches per game. That fell to 63 during the Isaiah Thomas year. Eric Bledsoe, the season prior, averaged 71 touches. That shot up to 79. Yeah. With Isaiah Thomas on the team. So it really is true. Dragic was spending less time. He was spending more time in the corner. I think people overemphasized a little bit to the extent to which Dragic was playing small forward and guarding bigger guys and standing in the corner. He really wasn't doing it too much. They only ran that lineup like a few minutes per game. But he was doing it a little bit. He was guarding bigger guys. When he did get the ball, he wasn't initiating at the same level, so he wasn't spending as much time with the ball in his hands. Obviously, it made sense for him to grow frustrated with that situation.
What did you think, Kellen? And do you think that Dragic should have been, or do you think he was angry from the beginning, or do you think it's something that took time for that to actually boil out to, or boil down to him actually being angry?
I don't know. That's a really good way of phrasing the question, because I think it's, did this build up, or did they sign Isaiah Thomas? Someone told him he signed Isaiah Thomas, and he looked around, and he was like, well, fuck this. Like, I'm out of here.
Right.
I don't know, but I do know that he was third team All NBA the season before, and he had to be looking at himself like he was an All Star guard, and for them to go and do that, and I think that the stats there are super telling on Dragic's touches going down and Bledsoe's kind of going up, because I always felt like when Bledsoe and Dragic were playing together the year before, the Suns felt that it was more of Bledsoe's team than Dragic's team, and they liked Bledsoe more. But it always seemed like on the court that Dragic was the better player and that it was kind of Goran's team. So there was always that divide going on between the two of them and the team regardless. So for them to bring in Thomas as well and make things even more difficult for Dragic, I think it was simple. And what a weird way for his career to unfold in Miami too. There's so many layers of this that are interesting. And obviously I think we overlook it because of how much we've talked about it. But obviously, like, Isaiah Thomas averaging 29 points a game, becoming an MVP candidate in Boston, and then 2 years later his career's over. That's probably the most interesting caveat of this, but there's several of them.
Right.
Right, and somehow the Suns still lost that trade. Here's my here's my theory. I think I can pinpoint the exact date that Goran Dragic became angry, and I'll explain why. My exact date that Goran Dragic became angry about the situation he was in was September 28th, 2014. And the reason I chose September 28th, 2014 is because on September 29th, 2014, the Phoenix Suns signed Zoran Dragic to a multi-year contract.
Yes.
Which, if any of you watched Zoran Dragic play, he was not an NBA player. It was clear that he was signed to make Goran Dragic happy. And
in his defense, didn't he have like a 25-30 point game for Miami once?
Zoran?
Like, yeah, well, they traded him. I'll look this up. They traded him, you know, halfway through the season, and then he had one good game, and then he went back to Slovenia.
Dude, he had 28 total points in his career. That's still a lot. That's more than I expected. I expected to see
28 total points. How many of those came in one game? Look at the game log.
I will look.
Yeah.
22 in a game. You're right. The last game of the year, April 15th, 9 of 17.
The Alec Peters.
He had an Alec Peters.
Yeah. Not as good as Alec Peters, though. Never.
No, Alec Peters, I still felt like he could have been at the end of some bench. I mean, that's the type of player you put at the end of a LeBron team bench and just hope that they get some minutes with him. But, you know, that to me was a moment, I think, the Zoran Dragic signing, where I was just kind of happy and I thought it was funny. But looking back, we should have probably just been like, that's kind of odd that they would sign Zoran Dragic. It was also a team that had two sets of brothers, if you remember, Marcus and Markieff Morris, and now Zoran and Goran Dragic, both on the same team. That was kind of odd. But going into that trade deadline, so as we were talking about before we got a little off the course here, the news cycle came out about Dragic being unhappy with the team. Now, my memory of this is that Isaiah Thomas never really said anything before the trade deadline. Is that your memory of it as well, Kellen?
Yeah, 100%. I remember the only thing that he said was like 6 weeks into the season when someone asked him, like, hey, do you want to start? He's like, yeah, of course I want to start. What? And then a couple people were like, oh, come on, man. You got to come here. No, you're coming off the bench. But at the same time, like, he's going to say that he wants to start if someone asks him. Not to backtrack completely here, but I think I looked up the box score completely, Sam, and I think this is my favorite basketball game of all time. Chris Anderson, Mario Chalmers, Luol Deng, Goran Dragic, Dwayne Wade, and Hassan Whiteside all did not play for the 37-45 Miami Heat. That means that Bill Walker, James Ennis III, Michael Beasley, and former Sun Tyler Johnson played all 48 minutes of this game.
Oh, my God.
Zoran Dragic played 40, and Udonis Haslam played 8, and they won by 4.
Udonis Haslam?
And they won by 4.
Oh, my God.
They won.
15-year Heat veteran Udonis Haslam only got 8 minutes when the entire team was out. They still only gave him 8 minutes.
And what team could lose to this Miami Heat squad but the era Philadelphia 76ers? Yeah.
I was so scared you were gonna say the Suns. The Suns were the team that lost that
game. You know
game.
What's amazing is, so yeah, IT didn't complain. Dragic didn't complain. Do you guys want to know
Dragic
which
complained.
Suns... He did right before the trade deadline, but going into February, this team was 28-20, right? They were on pace for another 48 season. Do you guys remember which guard actually was most disgruntled with their situation at this point? Who most openly kind of embraced the media?
I know the answer to this. I want to
know the answer. Kellen,
I want to know if Kellen
know
knows the answer.
Wait, is this the Gerald Green question?
No, it's not a Gerald Green question, but that's a good... See, we haven't even talked about Gerald Green. No, this is an Archie Goodwin question, and I think this just... It speaks... I want to know if you remember this quote, because it speaks to the absurdity of this team and the central theme, I think, of this episode, that the problem here was never about talent on paper. It was about taking the worst possible characters and trying to make that chemistry work when you cram it together, and it just doesn't work. Archie Goodwin was a second-year player, a 20-year-old, averaging 14 minutes per game. He shot 39% from the field, 29% from deep. For some reason, fans like us wanted to cling to the belief that maybe he was going to be something one day. Obviously, that turned out not to be the case. When the Suns acquired Reggie Bullock in a seemingly throwaway trade on, I think I have the date here. January 19th. Archie Goodwin, a day later, he gets interviewed about his reaction to the Reggie Bullock trade. And his quote is, he says to the reporter, quote, "I don't know what they're doing," referring to the front office. He says, quote, "Honestly, I really don't. I guess I know what they're doing. I guess they know what they're doing. I can just play ball and let them make the decisions. I don't know what the purpose is for it, but there's nothing I can do about it. Which is just an absurd response for a second-year player to have to, like, the ultimate bench warmer being acquired by your team. And again, kind of just speaks to the chaos that was falling all around this team even before Dragic officially requested the trade. You know, we had the Morris twins coming close to leading the league in technical fouls. You know, guys like Marcus Morris cursing out Jeff Hornacek on national TV in that national TV game against the Minnesota Timberwolves. That was in January. All of this happened before the ultimate crash and burn in February. Nuts.
This is when he benched guys for getting technicals, too.
That's right.
I'm trying to read the stories right now from back then because I don't remember covering it. But
well, just as a reminder, on January 8th versus the Timberwolves, Marcus Morris cursed out Jeff Hornacek on a national TV game. This happened in that season as well. There was so much odd things that happened this season. I think there was such a sense of hope, I think, after the 48-win season. And this season was more indicative of what the Ryan McDonough era will be remembered by, which is constant dysfunction, a misunderstanding of players' personalities, not understanding egos, valuing athleticism almost to a fault, and just sort of pissing players off that became sort of some players that were so lovable, like Goran Dragic, for example, and then keeping someone like Eric Bledsoe, who fans, maybe not rightfully so, didn't like as much. And I think not only that, but after the trade deadline, Ryan McDonough very specifically said, oh, we kept the best player on the Suns afterwards, just trying his best to throw some shade at Goran Dragic and Isaiah Thomas after that. Did you find anything else interesting in those stories, Kellen?
Yeah, I just think that maybe the writing was on the wall with this team with the technical foul issues in January and just how Hornacek had kind of... We haven't even brought him up yet. I think that he... How did he lose control of this team so quickly? I mean, the obvious answer is he has a Morris twins situation in his locker room.
He has a team of fucking lunatics. Fucking lunatics.
That's
who these people were. Yes, any coach would have lost it. I don't know. It's just, you know, like, because to me, I'm willing to go out on a limb and say we're all in agreement that the strategy worked, right? We've all said to this point that this team could win basketball games, regardless of if it's in 2015 or if it's in 2020, playing that strategy, right?
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean,
so if it's
terrible.
Just the chemistry, if it's just the chemistry that fell apart, you touched on this earlier, Mike. You said if Dragic was 30 years old, he would have been more open to this. Throw out Isaiah Thomas or Dragic or throw out one of them for a second and say that the year is 2015 and instead you bring in a player who's maybe 32, 33 years old, a veteran point guard who's actually been around the block, who is willing to teach these youngins, commit to the vision of winning. And maybe at the expense of touches and at the expense of minutes. You know, someone like a Mo Williams at the time, or a Jarrett Jack, or a guy like, I don't know, like even like a Tony Parker type of player. Sean Livingston, Tony Parker, you know, some type of player in that tier. They're a little bit older. They can still give you your 10 to 15 points per game, but they're willing to commit to that role. Are we in a completely different situation 5 years later today? Did the whole thing work and the Suns are now championship contenders and they've built upon that foundation that they had starting then? They added Devin Booker in the offseason because they still won roughly the same number of games and then they went on to make multiple playoff appearances. Is that where we are today if they had just had a veteran, a stable-minded veteran in that locker room?
Well, I have a question for both of you. Who was the leader of this team? And if you say PJ Tucker, I'm just going to remind you of the first thing we talked about.
No, it wasn't Super Tucker, and it wasn't Tucker, it wasn't Bledsoe,
Bledsoe's
and it wasn't
not a leader.
Either.
Dragic is Bledsoe's not really a leader. Isaiah Thomas is not really a leader.
The thing that I think is so funny is you go back to that Marcus Morris, the thing you were talking about where Marcus Morris is yelling at Hornacek on national TV. Go back and watch that video. You guys can YouTube it. You go, you watch it on YouTube. What do you see? You see Goran Dragic in the background kind of like weakly yelling, hey, Marcus, you know, cut that out. Like, you know, something like that. It's lip syncing, essentially. Not real leadership. He wasn't willing to stand up to the fucking lunatics next to him on this team. So, no, it wasn't Dragic either. And I don't know who possibly could have come in and handled that situation from a player standpoint.
I think Fry would have helped. Channing Fry is one of those guys that is a leader in the locker room. Maybe not on the court, but you can be a leader in the locker room. The strongest personalities tend to win out when the best players are not the strongest personalities, and that means that it's Marcus Morris and Markieff Morris, similar to the way that Draymond Green is one of the main leaders on the Warriors because Steph Curry and Klay Thompson just don't have strong personalities. Who do you think was the main leader of this team, Kellen?
Shavlik Randolph, 100%.
Well, that's when it went down, when they traded him for Reggie Bullock.
That's a really good point. I'm guessing that the Morris twins like had a grip on this locker room by like mid-November, and it just drove Hornacek crazy, and he tried his best to fix it. But he just couldn't get it there. I mean, it makes a lot of sense when you look at the group. Yeah, I think that maybe Fry was the more level-headed guy in the locker room that was like easier to. Sometimes what happens, and you learn this based on hearing a coach say something over and over again, and hearing his players say it over and over again. I can't tell you how many times that Devin Booker like basically repeats what Monty Williams told us the same day. It's like we'll talk to Monty after a shoot around. It'll be like. Lindsey Smith will just ask, like, what's the message for tonight's game? He'll say what the message is. And then Devin's asked, like, something not even close to that. And then he just brings up what Monty said to us, basically. And it's coaches getting through to the players. And I think what happens sometimes is a coach will get through to a certain player, and then that player will get through to the rest of the players. Like, I remember Tyson Chandler was that guy. A lot of the times he was consistent more with what was being said from his head coach where it wasn't from the other players. And I just think like Channing maybe could have been that for this team, but he definitely wasn't, and there wasn't anything there. I wish I would have been a couple years ahead in terms of like covering the team, because this would have been like a fascinating team to kind of look back on, and definitely right. Something that I would have written about like all these years later to look back on, and the reason we're talking about it for this long, because there's so many different layers of what went wrong, and then so many layers of what happened during it and after it, and just... The Hornacek thing I still can't get past. He finished third in coach of the year, and then 3 weeks into the season, he lost his locker room.
Yeah.
Stuff like that doesn't really happen.
And then he went on to coach the Knicks. I mean, what a bad – it's just such a bad career for him. I think let's just quickly get into the trades, if you will, because of how nuts – just to relive how insane that night was. Here's something I do not miss about Ryan McDonough. Waiting till the last second to do anything to try and milk the most possible assets out of whoever he's dealing with, because there was no news of these trades until I believe after the trade deadline had passed because of how late everything went down. But just to recap, I'll just read through it real quick and then we can give our quick reactions and wrap up on our final feelings about this team here. But as part of a three-team trade, this is off Basketball Reference, the Phoenix Suns traded Goran Dragic and Zoran Dragic to the Miami Heat. The Miami Heat traded Norris Cole, Justin Hamilton, Sean Williams to the New Orleans Pelicans. And they also traded Danny Green, a 2017 first-round draft pick, which we have to talk about that, and a 2021 first-round draft pick to the Phoenix Suns, and the New Orleans Pelicans, which I didn't even remember they were part of this trade for the record, traded John Salmons to the Phoenix Suns. 2017.
You don't remember Suns legend John Salmons?
No, I completely forgot about that. And then, as part of a separate three-team trade, the Phoenix Suns traded 2018 first-round draft pick, which ended up being, do you know, Kellen?
Oh, gosh, I do not.
Mikal Bridges, because that pick was traded back to the Suns from Philadelphia later. So it changed hands a few times and then back to the Phoenix Suns. So the Suns traded 2018 first-round draft pick to the 76ers and Tyler Ennis, Miles Plumlee to the Bucks. The Bucks traded Brandon Knight and Kendall Marshall, which I also forgot about, to the Phoenix Suns. The Philadelphia 76ers traded MCW, former Rookie of the Year, to the Milwaukee Bucks. And then finally, maybe the worst one of all, as part of a three-team trade, the Suns traded Isaiah Thomas to the Boston Celtics. Boston Celtics traded, this is a weird name, Tayshaun Prince, forgot about that, to the Detroit Pistons. Remember them? The Boston Celtics traded Marcus Thornton and a 2016 first-round draft pick. Scalabissier was that pick, by the way, to the Phoenix Suns. You can remember what that trade was, or that pick was used on. And the Detroit Pistons traded Gigi Datome and Jonas Repko to the Celtics. Phoenix 2016 first round draft pick received from Boston is Cleveland's pick, by the way, and was top 10 protected. Whew! That was a lot of stuff to happen in one night. Kellen, do you remember this night? And I'm sure Sam has your article about it written up
no,
still.
I don't. Yeah.
Do you remember this night? Or what is, obviously we got your initial reaction, but in hindsight, what do you think about this night?
I remember tweeting Brandon Knight is a two guard. I can't stop dancing because I was so excited and thought Brandon Knight was to like should. He was like a polarizing player for me for 2 years, and I thought he was really good, but he just needed to chill on being on the ball so much. And I thought if he just went off the ball more, and then this trade happens, and I'm like, oh my god, it's perfect. Like this, I think he's gonna be so good in this offense. And I'll share a tweet that I actually went through just now and like looked at my tweets from the day, and I replied to an Adrian Wojnarowski tweet with "huh," and he said, "If Miami can include Norris Cole in a Dragic deal with Suns, Cole could be shipped through to Detroit." So something happened in this trade where Norris Cole was a part of it at some point. The Suns were like, uh-uh, we don't want Norris Cole. No, thank you. Which, right call. I remember being in the, I can't remember if I was in the newsroom yet at the time. I think I was because all the trades happened in the last 15 minutes of the deadline. So for us, like having stories planned ahead of time and like having a story ready for when Dragic gets traded and if, I think we had one ready for when Dragic was traded, but I mean, that was it, obviously. Like, we didn't have one ready for Isaiah Thomas. Like, it was pretty obvious in the last couple of days where it's like, okay, they're going to move one of them, and then it'll be Dragic, obviously, and then they'll just keep Thomas and Bledsoe, which wasn't a great fit, but we'll figure it out from there. And I just remember being super excited about the price that they got Dragic for, because remember, it was like Josh McRoberts and, like, all these contracts we were looking at some point. I was like, oh, gross, like, that's going to be it. And then they got the picks, which turned out to be good. And then I'm glad that McDonough finally like did something because he never really was taking risks. And of course, the first risk he took was the worst trade he has ever made in his life, which was the Brandon Knight trade. But he eventually had to do something with that pick, and he did, which I was happy for. And I liked those deals. Now, getting rid of Isaiah Thomas for nothing, for basically nothing, was a problem I had. But you got a first-round pick for him, and you didn't have him 6 months ago or 9 months ago. So I was also fine with that, but then he goes on to become an MVP candidate. Brandon Knight's career is over within 3 years. There's just a whole lot that went wrong for them off of that.
Sam, do you remember how you felt?
Yeah, I felt pretty happy at the same time, too, given the circumstances. Mostly ecstatic because of the two first-round picks that they got for Goran Dragic. I thought that was way more value. You know, he basically trapped them into a corner by saying he would only go to three different teams and demanding a trade. My question to you guys, because I honestly don't remember, so the Suns got two picks out of that deal with the Heat. The second one, the famous 2021 pick, they then used to get Mikal Bridges back after they traded the pick that would become Mikal Bridges, and then they traded that pick plus other stuff to get back the pick that would become Mikal Bridges, and so they got Mikal Bridges. Right, that's what happened. Mm-hmm. The first pick in that trade, do you guys remember what happened to it? Because I honestly don't. Did it belong to the Heat? Did it belong to another team? It was 2017, I want to say.
It's top seven protected, so maybe the Heat kept it somehow. Is that possible?
Kellen, do you remember?
What pick, sorry?
It's a 2017 first-round pick from the Miami Heat.
It was top five? Oh, the one they got from Miami.
Yeah, who did that turn into?
The first one they got from Miami, yeah. Did they move that in another deal? I can't even remember.
Oh, my God. I'm going to look because now it's pissing me off that I don't remember.
Yeah, I don't remember either. We looked, actually. Sam and I tried finding who that ended up being, and we couldn't figure out who it ended up being.
Again, speaks to the absurdity of that whole era and the chaos in general. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Very odd. I do have something I want to read to you guys. Let me bring it up here. This is a letter from Lon Babby that was sent to Phoenix Suns ticket holders, season ticket holders. And I have a few sections of it that I want to read. Yesterday may have been the busiest day in the history of Phoenix Suns basketball. In total, we facilitated three transactions that not only make us younger, but improve our team and position us incredibly well moving into the future. Below is a breakdown of yesterday's trade, and there's literally three full paragraphs breaking down all of the trades to try and explain it to season ticket holders, and then he wraps it all up by saying, make no mistake about it, Our short-term focus is to make the NBA playoffs this season, and we will compete hard every night to do so. These transactions were consistent with our fundamental goal of creating sustained success and being a perennial championship contender in the future. As I have stated in previous communications, we will continue making the right and often tough decisions to accomplish our ultimate goal of consistently competing for NBA championships while serving as a foundational piece of this great community. So classic, classic stuff of saying, don't worry, we're going to make the playoffs this year and continue being a championship contender going forward. As we all know, the real tank began the next season, which is what made Eric Bledsoe eventually force his way off of the team. What we didn't touch on was how dysfunctional it got with Goran Dragic, to the point of him publicly saying the teams he wanted to be traded to, which we noted, but also saying that he did not trust the front office. Now, Lon Babby still worked for the Suns this season. Do you guys remember what happened to Lon Babby after this season?
He resigned, did he? I don't remember.
He was basically fired, right? And who was promoted into his place? Ryan McDonough.
Yeah, oh, right, well, yeah. here's my question that I wanted to ask you, Mike, because I've seen you publicly say this take numerous times, is that this is the point at which, and I don't disagree, you should have fired Ryan McDonough.
Correct. That's the irony of him being promoted.
My question to you is, how do you have the balls to do it for a team that, because if we take it back a couple seasons, 2012-13, the first year post-Nash, Goran Dragic running the show, they win 25 games. This is, up to that point, a team that for the previous 25 years had this very sustained period of success, was one of the greatest organizations in the NBA. One down year, you bring in Ryan McDonough, they surprisingly win 48 games when you think you're going to tank. Going into the trade deadline the following season, they're on pace for another roughly 45-win season. So even given all the dysfunction, do you think that if you were Robert Sarver, could you have actually fired him at that point? Would it have been a good look for you?
Well, I think that it's possible he would have taken some heat from the media, but I think no matter what the decisions he's making, at that time he's likely taking a lot of heat from the media. But I think it's important to note that this season was dysfunctional from the beginning, starting with the super extreme DUI to the Marcus Morris screaming at his coach on a national TV game, to the most beloved player on the team, Goran Dragic, asking off the team, demanding a trade, and then saying he no longer trusted the front office. Then Ryan McDonough losing multiple trades. I agree with Kellen, his take at the time and his take now, that the Dragic trade on its own, with the position that he was put in, was a good trade. But had he handled the season better, had he understood the egos and the personalities of the players better, he would have never been put in that position to begin with. It can be argued that Ryan McDonough put himself in that position. I think a lot of people at the time pointed fingers at Goran Dragic and blamed Goran Dragic, but how could you blame Goran Dragic when you understand the season he had just had and then the role that he was placed into after that? That is a decision made by the person putting the team together. And I think if you look back on it, and I even said this at the time, I just thought this is where I lost any sort of hope for Ryan McDonough, because I was not a big fan of Brandon Knight. I admittedly had not watched a lot of Brandon Knight, so I didn't really have any strong opinions. But I knew what I knew about Goran Dragic. And at the time, due to them kind of putting it together, as Kellen Olsen talked about here a few minutes ago, Isaiah Thomas started quickly becoming one of my favorite players on the Suns. So for all of that to be so badly mismanaged after that 48-win season, this is the moment I think any competent owner would have probably said, this guy is pissing off the best players that we have on our team. Maybe he's not fit to be a general manager. And I think especially in this era of the NBA, where you can't just make players do whatever you want, they're not chess pieces. They have the real power in the dynamic between players, owners, and general managers. And I think if Ryan McDonough has any downfall, it's not understanding that more than anything else. And forgive me for going on a long diatribe here, but I think I think that he just has so many problems with this season, with this specific season. And at the end of it, I mean, it would have been nice to fire him before he signed Brandon Knight to that disastrous contract. That's for sure. But what do you think about that take, Kellen? Am I far off on that? How did you feel at the time?
No, not at all. At the time, I was very supportive of him, and I remain one of the people who looks back on him and is much. I'm probably one of the highest people on him, even looking back on it with how much he screwed things up. I liked where his head was at in terms of asset management and just not really trying to panic. And he was always really patient. But at a certain point, he needed to make moves, and at a certain point, he didn't make moves. Like, once there was the move to make, a la like the Kyrie Irving trade, which, I mean, who knows how that would have gone, or like going after someone like DeMarcus Cousins, or the time when Kristaps was available for like 48 hours, there were times for him to be aggressive, and then he wasn't. So it was kind of confusing to try and keep track of where he was, and that's where I go back to in my head, like, okay, well, how much was he really controlling? How much of this was Robert Sarver meddling with him? How many of his moves were actually his, and how many were Sarver's? And it's just impossible for us to say. And I'm not trying to use Sarver as a excuse to say, like, McDonough, like, shouldn't take any blame. Like, he should take a whole lot of blame and should take the most blame out of anyone. But it's hard to look at his moves and other moves respectively as that. I have a fun Ryan McDonough story before we like kind of close things out. I was at our office about a year ago. I want to say it was the day after Igor got fired. I was trying to remember off the top of my head what big thing happened for the Suns that day. But I walked out of our office, and there are bathrooms right next to the elevator. And I walked out the door, and I saw him at the elevator. And I knew that he was going into using our studio space to record some SiriusXM radio stuff. Like, I'm sure you guys have seen on Twitter that he's been doing that the past mm-hmm. season or two. Mm-hmm. So I saw him, and I just gave him a head nod and kept walking, because it was one of those weird things where, like, I know, like, the type of day it is. I'm not going to, like, make a dumb joke to him or whatever. And in general, I'm the type of person where if I see someone that I kind of know but not really know, like, we've talked to each other, like, face-to-face a couple of times at Sun stuff, like, I'm not going to try and act like we're buddies or whatever. So I just gave him a head nod and kept walking, and then he said to me as I was walking away, he's like, busy day for you, huh? And I was just like, yeah, man, yeah, you can't really say anything about it, though, can you? And he was like, nope, I got about, like, 6 months left or so until I can. And I was like, well, when you get those 6 months up, come talk to me, I'll talk to you. And then he joked, and he was like, okay, sounds good, as if to say, like, I'm not going to talk to you, but sounds good, pal. And then he went on the elevator. I went to the bathroom, and that was that. And it was a really kind of funny thing where...
That sounds really tense.
Yeah, super intense. Yeah. Like, of all the days we, like, randomly run into him, it was like the day after Igor got fired as the Suns continued to be like a clown show after he was gone. So, yeah, he's just a really interesting guy to look back at. But obviously, when you whiff as much as he did on some of these things, like, we haven't even brought up, like, the draft history and all that kind of stuff. We mentioned Tyler Ennis for, like, 5 seconds. Like, he obviously deserved to be fired for even, like, a year or two, honestly. He was running out of time for way too long. Like, it was clear, like, a year or two before he got fired that if he got fired at any point, it would have made sense.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. Any final thoughts on the 14-15 team, Sam?
Not particularly on the 14-15 team, but I guess the last thing I want to say is kind of the so what of this conversation as you listen to it in 2020. Why does this stuff matter? And I think what we've sort of established today is that, A, we all think that the 14-15 team could succeed in today's game, not necessarily with the same exact pieces because of the chemistry issues, but because the basketball strategy is there. And I think it raises interesting questions about how the Suns are building their current team. You know, currently they have not three good guards, but they have two. In Devin Booker, obviously being an all-star, a bona fide all-star, superstar at this point. And then Ricky Rubio, who's kind of aging, but coming off arguably his best season at this point. And I think the conversation you can have there is, well, if the 14-15 team didn't quite work the way you wanted it to, but you believe that you could get those pieces to fit, if only one of the players was an aging veteran and kind of willing to buy into that system, can we envision a situation where Ricky Rubio is now that guy for the Suns today? And, you know, whoever it may be, if the Suns want to go into this draft class and try to find one of the many top point guard talents that are available, or if they want to explore avenues to upgrade their guard positions and find another self-creator through free agency or through a trade, do we believe that Ricky Rubio is a guy who in the future would be willing to take a backseat and kind of implement a similar system? And would that work for the Suns? And how does that affect Devin Booker and Devin Booker's ability to ever play point guard again? And if we even want that to happen? I think these are all great conversations that we could talk about. And, you know, other things just like exploring small ball. you know, if the 2015 team was going to succeed in today's game. Do we want Kelly Oubre to be the future long-term starting power forward of the Suns? There's a great argument for that at this point. So, you know, I think all of this stuff has these ramifications, these consequences as they affect the game today. And, you know, I think that's kind of why it's important to keep talking about it.
Yeah, my final thoughts, and Kellen, I do want to say sorry for keeping you so long on this conversation here, but my final thoughts are something that I actually, in when this conversation kind of broke out on Twitter from the Isaiah Thomas post, something that I think made me sad about the Phoenix Suns after this season is something about what became known as Hydra on, on the Suns Reddit, or the three-headed dragon, the three-point guard lineups. Something about it felt like a team experimenting in a way to try to take advantage of things that are happening on the fringes, try to change what they're doing so drastically from what other teams are doing in a way that causes them to have an advantage versus other teams, similar to the way that the Houston Rockets, of course, are doing now. Obviously, that's a different extreme and a completely different philosophy, but the point is that they are dealing in those margins where they're trying to get an advantage any way possible. The Phoenix Suns, for a while, were that team with Mike D'Antoni. And something about experimenting with that three-guard lineup made me feel like the Phoenix Suns were a team that was willing to take risks to try and be innovative in a way that other teams maybe were not. Now, whether or not those risks worked out could have been something that would have been changed in the future, of course. But when it ended, it does feel like the Suns are no longer that team in any way at all. And other teams have sort of taken that mantle from them. So I do miss the idea of rooting for a team or even covering a team that is willing to take risks. Like the Houston Rockets, where they just got rid of a center entirely and they're just trying something so drastically different just to try and take advantage of any sort of innovative opportunity that they do have. So I do miss the idea of the Suns being that team. So I think from that perspective, I'm still kind of sad about that in a way. But we'll see. Maybe it's something they do in the future. But they are the team that picked DeAndre Ayton over Luka Doncic. Now, I'm not saying that DeAndre Ayton's a bad player. I am saying that Luka Doncic would have been the player to take if you were trying to be different and innovative, and taking a gigantic center in today's NBA shows a willingness to be a little bit more traditional in your team building, which is what it is. And of course, that was one of Ryan McDonough's last moves that he ever made. So who knows who it is and who actually made that pick. But Kellen, do you have any other final thoughts on this team?
No, not really. Not really. I think we covered most of it. I think that we're probably forgetting like five or six things where people listening will bring it up in the comments or
I hope so.
In the tweets or whatever, kind of saying like, I can't believe you guys didn't talk about Brandon Wright for more than 5 seconds. Or like something like that. Something obvious that we're forgetting. The one thing that did come in my mind that we didn't mention about is I wrote this super long piece about I've never written anything more to get a more obvious conclusion in my life than when I wrote this Gerald Green thing after the 13-14 season, where my conclusion was, he takes a lot of bad shots. They go in, so who cares? Like, that was the whole thing. And then guess what? Those bad shots started not really going in as much the next season. And that was, like, one of those weird things in that team where, like, they weren't getting the same Gerald Green. It was, like, is Marcus the better Morris twin kind of buzz was coming. It was a really weird season, but, like, really fun to, like, watch in real time and look back on for sure.
Yep. The two takes I was the proudest finding in those old Reddit threads were, I advocated for getting Jared Dudley back over Gerald Green and keeping Channing Frye. And those two guys could have been the stabilizing forces in the locker room. Who knows if they were there? Maybe there'd still be a three-guard team in Phoenix to this day. But Kellen Olson, thank you so much for joining us on this podcast that Sam and I anticipated would be 45 minutes. That is now over an hour and 10 minutes. So thank you for joining us on this one. Don't forget to follow Kellen Olson. I'm sure you already do at Kellen Olson on Twitter. Read all of his stories on arizonasports.com and listen to his podcast. Kellen, do you have anything else you'd like to plug?
No, you guys don't worry about it at all. This was the most fun part of my day. I had a lot of fun. I guess I haven't had a platform to say this. So look, people, I realize that like I'm probably going to have Stockholm Syndrome in like 3 months if this keeps up. But stay the fuck inside, you dipshits. Like, let's go. Like, let's all, like, hunker together here and be serious about this.
There we go.
Because my God, I just like some of my, and I don't know like where your listener base is. So
are people behaving in Arizona?
They are for the most part, but then yeah. I just hear about like my friend's younger brother and I hear he has like friends over and I'm like, dog, like what do you, like there's like 5 or 10 people in a room together and I'm just like, come on people. Like I'm really miss seeing my friends right now too, but yeah, like stay inside, please. Like we're going to get through this, but we just need to just really work together for a couple of weeks, couple of months, and we'll be okay. But if we keep just slipping up, then it's not going to get worse necessarily. I don't think, I don't want to go down that road. I regret not bringing this up entirely, but it's not going to get, we're going to keep hurting ourselves, I guess, if we don't stay inside. So please stay inside. Okay, thanks.
Yes, I agree with that. And this is now the closing of every podcast, but if you have any ideas for our next episode, feel free to send them our way. We, of course, are looking for things to talk about. This was just sort of a random idea that we had. Hopefully you enjoyed it. And if you do, let us know. If you have any thoughts or anything that we should talk about, of course, let us know that as well. Don't forget, I'm sure Kellen Olsen has a piece going up soon, or if not already, about ASU's brand new recruit to the basketball team. Make sure to read that. But thanks, everyone, for listening.